All right, we're on our way. Session 69, lesson 14, page 1. And as you come to page 1, you see that it is our mini table of contents for lesson 14. So we've only got lesson 14, 15, and 16 to go. So we will get through this class someday. I don't promise you when. All right, so you see I should say lesson 14 only consists of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sections, starting with the suicide of Judas, and then we begin the journey to Golgotha. All right, so let's turn then to section 232, page 2 of your outline. Section 232 is at the top of page 231 in your harmony. The remorse and suicide of Judas Iskariot. Judas, the man from the town of Kiriat. Judas Iskariot. The only Judean in the bunch. Everybody else were Galileans. Now, last week we finished up the religious trials of Yeshua. And now we're moving toward the civil trial, but in between these two trials, or these types of trials, Judas will die. And that's what we come to in Matthew 27. Let's start with verses 3 and 4. Everybody on page 231, the left-hand column, verses 3 and 4. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What is that to us? See to that yourself." Now, the NASB that you're reading from says that he felt remorse. Some translations use the word repent there, that Judas repented. And that's caused a lot of confusion because, Judas was the son of perdition. He was the one that's going to be lost. Satan entered into him. How could he repent? And people are confused by that word. So we need to look at the two Greek words for repentance. There are two key words that are many times translated repentance in the Greek New Testament. The first one is a noun. And a noun that means to change your mind. And this speaks of salvation repentance, metanoia. It is not the word used here. The other word is a verb. In it has a strong emphasis on the emotional, metamelomai. It speaks of remorse or regret. This is the word used in the case of Judas, metamelomai. Now, Dr. Strong, in his exhaustive concordance of the Bible, had a nice comparison between these two words. So I've reproduced it here for you so we can get a close understanding of the words. In the left-hand column will be metamelomai, and in the right-hand column, metaneo or metanoia. Same word, just different forms. Now, metamelomai refers to an emotional change. That's the source of the change. While metanoia refers to a change of choice, the source of the change is the will. So for one, the source of change is the emotions. For the other, the source of change is the will. Okay, because our soul is made up of mind, will, and emotions. So there's different sources for these two words. Metamelomai refers to particulars, certain specific things, while metanoia has reference to the entire life. So the scope of the two words is different. Metamelomai, a limited scope. Metanoia, a very large scope. Your entire life is in view when you're speaking of metanoia. Okay, make sense so far?
Yeah, how about you give that to us?
You guys want all these slides? Okay. Yeah, we'll get you these slides then. I better write that down or I'll forget. I should have figured it out and had them ready here for you. All right. And the third major difference between these two words, metamelomai signifies nothing but regret, even amounting to remorse. So the scope of the word can be minor or major. You know, regret is minor. You know, you kind of regret that you ate that piece of candy, right? and then you soon forget about it. But remorse is a much deeper emotion and stays with you longer. So that's the range of metamelomai, but metanoia, Dr. Strong says, is the fuller and nobler term expressive of moral action and issues. Okay, so it's a much higher quality term. Metamelomai is a kind of a, maybe you could call it a casual term, and metanoia a serious term. So that's the difference between the two, and it's metamelomai that's used in regard to Judas. So remorse is the better translation. Judas, knowing that Jesus had been condemned by the religious trial, is filled with remorse. So he returns the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, and he confesses that he's sinned and he's betrayed innocent blood. You know, he's guilt-ridden, and he tries to atone for his guilt by getting rid of the money, as though that would do it. But what else can he do? What else can he do? So he tries to rid himself of the guilt. They refuse to accept the money back. So he tosses it into the sanctuary and leaves his guilt undiminished, probably increased. His guilt and remorse probably even worse at this point in time. Verse 5, Matthew 27, verse 5. He threw the pieces of silver into the sanctuary and departed, and he went away and hanged himself. So he goes away directly and he commits suicide by hanging, apparently in response to this depression and guilt bearing down on his shoulders. What a difference between him and Yeshua. What a difference between him and us. Yeshua bore the guilt of the world, and he could take it. Judas bore his own guilt, and it crushed him. And it crushed him. Now, aren't you glad you don't have to bear your own guilt? You know, that's what happens when you have to bear your own guilt. Depression, you get crushed by it. And those who don't have their guilt borne by Jesus will bear it for eternity. Not a pretty thought. Not at all.
Now, did he realize that Yeshua was Messiah and what he had done, he had betrayed God?
It doesn't say that. It doesn't. We don't know exactly what his thinking is. Right. He at least knew that he was wrong.
Right.
He at least knew that he had betrayed an innocent man.
Yes, sir.
At least he knew that. Now, all this seems in conflict with the Acts account. The Acts account is the right-hand column, Acts 1, verses 18 and 19. So let's read verses 18 and 19. Now this man acquired a field with the price of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. I could not find an illustration of that. I didn't look that hard. I will admit, I didn't look that hard. And it became known to all who were living in Jerusalem, so that in their own language that field is called Hakaldama, that is, the field of blood.
In their own language?
In the Hebrew language. Dam, blood, ha, the. So to put it together, you have Hakaldama, a field of blood. All right, now there really is no conflict between the two accounts. You have to just simply look at Jewish law to understand what's going on. So now we're on page 3. Top of the page, it says harmonizing Matthew and Acts. Jewish law regarding the body. So remember where we are in the timeline. The first night of Passover is over. We're about to come to the first day of Passover, when the morning Passover sacrifice is to be offered, the Chagigah, the festival peace offering. Now, the priesthood would partake of this sacrifice. They would eat this sacrifice before the sunset. However, according to the traditional law, if there was a dead body in Jerusalem, if there was a corpse in Jerusalem, then the city was considered defiled and the morning sacrifice could not be offered. So the Jewish law goes on to say that if the body is taken and thrown into the Valley of Hinnom, then the city is considered cleansed, and the sacrifice can be offered, the sacrifice can be eaten. So then later on, you can return and you can bury the body. Now, the Valley of Hinnom was the city's garbage dump and a place of burning. Now, here's a map of Jerusalem in the first century. And the Valley of Hinnom is the valley that curves around the western and southern end of the city. And the most important section of the Valley of Hinnom we'll be looking at in just a few minutes, which is the southern section. Modern Mount Zion is on the western side, but that's not the correct designation. That's the western hill. Mount Zion is where you see the term lower city there. That's going up to Mount Zion, the biblical Mount Zion.
But today they call it the one.
Yes, to the west of the, let me back up, to the west of the Kidron Valley there, west of that arrow, that's the western hill. It's called Mount Zion today. The wrong designation for it.
And there's the Mount Zion Hotel there.
Yeah. And you shouldn't call it Mount Zion. That's an improper designation. It's the Western Hill. Now, I'm standing where the X is, and I'm standing on the Mount of Olives there, and I'm looking across the Mount of Olives and down to the confluence of the Valley of Hinnom and the Kidron Valley. That's where the next picture is taken from. Okay, can you see that? Now, here is the Valley of Hinnom. There's Gehinnom, the garbage dump, the place of burning. Nobody builds anything down there, even today. And the Kidron Valley is coming in front of me right here. And the confluence of the two, of course, on the left side. So there is the Valley of Hinnom as it looks today, curving around the southern side of the city, the old city. All righty. Now the Hebrew for this valley is Gehinnom. And we, from that term, Gehinnom, we get the term Gehenna. That's where Gehenna comes from. Now, with this background, we can harmonize Matthew and Acts. Apparently, what Judas did was hang himself while still within the city walls. The city is now defiled for Passover. Somebody finds the corpse. The law says they can throw the body into the Valley of Hinnom. So they do. And the city is now cleansed. The morning sacrifice, the Haggigah, can now be offered. So Judas's body was thrown down the steep cliffs into the Valley of Hinnom, and with the fall, the body split open. And later on, they came and they buried him. Now, what about the 30 pieces of silver? Let's take a look at verse 6, Matthew 27, verse 6. And the chief priests took the pieces of silver and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood." Now you see the rabbinic logic here? No, they were part of this. They recognized the money was wrongfully gained. And they were personally involved in that. So the price of blood was forbidden to be used in the temple treasury. So page 4 at the top, what's their reaction to this problem? Page 4 at the top of the page. Let's read Matthew 27, 7 and 8. Matthew 27, 7 and 8. As we continue down the Matthew column on page 231. And they counseled together and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. So they bought the potter's field. And this is the potter's field as it looks today, this monastery with the wall all around it. Now, why you would want to build a monastery there, I don't know. But wherever there's a spot mentioned in the Bible, there goes a church on the top of it, just about every place. Here's another view of it taken from the south looking north. You can see the wall around the potter's field, the Kaldama, the field of blood. Here's another view of it that I photographed as well. So there's the location today. There's the location today. Excuse me? I don't know. Either Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, maybe Russian Orthodox, an Orthodox sect of some sort. But I don't know. I'd have to look that up. Now, Acts chapter 1, verses 18 and 19 states that Judas, this man, bought the field with the reward of his iniquity, and that it's called the field of blood. Now, how did Judas attain the field when the Matthew account says the field was purchased by the high priests. That seems contradictory. But the explanation becomes apparent when Jewish law is considered. So we're at the heading Jewish law regarding the money. By traditional law, money that was wrongfully gained could not be used for the temple treasury. And so they had two options about what to do with the money. First of all, return it to the owner. Well, they can't do that. Judas is dead, right? So that option doesn't exist. The second option they have, use it for the public good. So that's the option available to them. So they purchased this field in the Valley of Hinnom for the burying of strangers, for the burying of people that don't have family to claim the body. And the first being Judas. Yes?
How many feet do you think the original plot of the field would be to where there, you know, like where that church is?
What's the question?
Well,
I don't understand the question.
Okay, the original plot of the field.
Right.
How far down from where the land is now would that plot of the field be?
Well, it's down. It's down the hill, almost to the bottom of Valley of Hinnom. Kind of toward the bottom. I don't know what the footage would be there, but it's down the hill toward the very bottom of the valley. Okay, so they purchased this field for the public good, a place to bury people whose body wasn't claimed by the family. So the field, though, had to be bought in the name of Judas by Jewish law. So in that sense, Judas did obtain the field. They bought it with his money in his name. Now, another point of confusion is also in verse 9. Now, let's turn to page 5 at the top of the page. And we're looking at the heading, The Significance of Jeremiah. So let's read Matthew 27, 9 and 10 as we come to the end of that column. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them to the potter's field as the Lord directed me. All right, what's the significance of Jeremiah here? Well, there's a two-part explanation. The first deals with the fact that Matthew is using the name Jeremiah as a title for the prophets. And there's an excerpt in your outline from Encyclopedia Judaica. Here it is up on the screen. If you go to Encyclopedia Judaica and look up Jeremiah, you'll find this in the article. In the prevalent Masoretic editions, the book of Jeremiah is placed after the book of Isaiah. That's what we have today. According to an old order suggested by Bava Batra 14b and 15a, it was placed at the beginning of the latter prophets, before Ezekiel and Isaiah. So today it's Jeremiah is placed afterwards. Then it was placed before. So in the Talmud, Jeremiah is listed as the first prophetic book. So what Matthew is doing here, he's using an idiomatic expression that means what was spoken of by the prophets. He's summing up the prophets there. He's doing a summation. Now remember this chart? The New Covenant usage of the passages in Tanakh in earlier lessons. There was four ways that the rabbis and the New Testament use Old Testament passages under the column usage, literal prophecy and literal fulfillment, literal prophecy and typical fulfillment, literal prophecy plus application, and then what's happening here, summation, summing up in a sentence or two what the prophets taught. So that's what Matthew is doing. He's doing a summation, and he's combining Zechariah 11, 12, and 13 with Jeremiah. And if you look at your harmony at the very bottom of the column, you see the cross references. There, Zechariah 11, Jeremiah 18, Jeremiah 19, 11, 32. He's stringing all those verses together. And that's called pearl stringing by the rabbis. Okay, we do it too, don't we? We pull out applicable verses and we put them all together. Well, that's what the rabbis are doing there. They called it pearl stringing. Pearl stringing. Well, I don't have it on the top of my head right now. Yeah, I talked about it a while back.
Yeah. Illustration you just had.
Mm-hmm.
That's
No, not this one, the one with the columns. This one. May I please have a copy of
it? You have a copy of it in your notes. Yes, exactly. You have it on Lesson 2, page 16. Okay, Lesson 2, page 16 is where you have this chart. Okay, because we went over it. We went over it a long time ago, I know. Okay? All righty. So, this is a summary statement at the bottom of the page there, bottom of page 5. It's a summary statement, and there's an article on pearl stringing there. Perhaps that term you're looking for, Monica, will be there. And so it's a summary statement plus pearl stringing. Okay, that's the first part of the explanation. The second part of the explanation concerns Tophet. So we're at page 6 now. Point 2 at the top of the page, Tophet. And a reference to Tophet is found in Zechariah 11:13. And the 30 pieces of silver. The 30 pieces of silver is found in Zechariah 11:13. Then the Lord said to me, "Throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them." So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. So there's a reference to the 30 shekels of silver. Now, what does Jeremiah have to do with it? We've looked at Zechariah. Now, what does Jeremiah have to do with it? Well, there are various explanations. First of all, to the liberal unbeliever, this is a proof against biblical inspiration. See, they didn't know what they were talking about. Bible's wrong. Secondly, the conservative theologian usually explains this as an error. Well, one of the scribes messed it up there, put the wrong prophet down. But there's a better explanation if we understand the entire picture in light of the coming judgment of AD 70. And that explanation comes in Jeremiah 7 and Jeremiah 19. Now again, the Valley of Hinnom extends from the western to the southern side of the city. Okay, there's the Valley of Hinnom again. It was used for human sacrifice by the kings of Judah. And that's again where we get the concept of Gehenna, the lake of fire, burning humans, because it was a garbage dump. There was a constant fires burning there. It wasn't a pleasant place. Now, in the days of Jeremiah, because of the sinfulness of Israel, Jeremiah was sent to the Valley of Hinnom to a specific section called Tophet. Now, as we look at the map again, this is the Tophet section of the Valley of Hinnom, that southern section from the curve down to the confluence of the Kidron. That is the section called Tophet. All right? Make sense? All right. Now, Jeremiah was sent to that section of the valley, and he pronounced a curse upon that section of the valley, and he called it the Valley of Slaughter. Here's Jeremiah 7, 30 through 32. "For the sons of Judah have done that which is evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house, which is called by my name, to defile it." So they set up idols in the temple. "They have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command and did not come into my mind." So human sacrifice was being practiced in Tophet. "Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no longer be called Tophet, or the Valley of the Son of Hinnom, but the Valley of the Slaughter, for they will bury in Tophet because there is no other place." See the curse? The curse upon that valley. And then in Jeremiah 19, "Therefore, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when this place will no longer be called Tophet, or the Valley of Ben-Hinnom, but rather the Valley of Slaughter." So that's the curse. The curse predicts that the Jewish people, or the enemies of the Jewish people, will bury and bury and bury and bury there until there's no more room for graves. Now, centuries later, the leaders of Israel used the 30 pieces of silver to purchase a specific place in the Valley of Hinnom. They bought the very area of Tophet. When they purchased the potter's field in Tophet, they purchased the curse that went with it. And the curse was finally fulfilled in 70 AD with the massive slaughter of the residents of Jerusalem by the Romans. The Romans had been waiting for 2 years to break through the walls, and they wreaked their vengeance on the people in the city. As Jeremiah said, they slaughtered and slaughtered and slaughtered. They buried and buried and buried until they finally reached a point that there was no more room to bury in the Valley of Hinnom. So it is not a mistake that Matthew mentions Jeremiah. Rather, he wants to indicate that what is happening is the purchase of Tophet and the purchase of the curse that went along with it. Now we're at the top of page 7. Go to the top of page 7. So Matthew's Gospel is written in light of the impending judgment of 70 AD. That's the point he wants to make. Zechariah mentions the price, 30 shekels of silver. Jeremiah dwells on the concept of the curse that came with buying that potter's field. And all of this comes together. All of this finds its unity in the understanding of the nature of the unpardonable sin and the judgment of AD 70. The AD 70 judgment was a direct result of the unpardonable sin. All right, and on the bottom of page 7, you have the map I've been showing you and a little article on Tophet in the Valley of Hinnom, the Tophet part of the Valley of Hinnom. So turn to page 8, the section entitled Roman Law. Now, during the religious trials, we saw the issue was blasphemy. But the issue in the civil trial is sedition against Rome, rebellion against Rome. And we need to note two things in regard to Roman law. First of all, the proceedings had to be public. The proceedings had to be public. So both times there's a trial before Pilate, a multitude is there. Pilate has public hearings. He's following Roman law. And secondly, in order to begin the proceedings, they had to be based on a specific charge. A prosecuting witness had to bring a specific charge. So here Judas is needed. He's needed as the prosecuting witness before Pilate. But in between the religious and civil trials, Judas will commit suicide, or he did commit suicide, we just saw that. And therefore the trial will not go as smoothly as planned. Alrighty. So we're now at page 9. On page 9 you have an article about Pontius Pilate. A real sweetheart, you need to know something about this guy. Now, when you go to Israel, you'll go to Caesarea on the Sea, and when you go to Caesarea, you will see this stone. This is a reproduction of the original. The original is kept in a safe place, so it won't get withered. So this is a casting. And on this stone, which was being reused in another building, was found an inscription naming Pontius Pilate. And you can see the word, the top word there is part of the inscription, Tiberius Caesar. Below that you can see part of Pontius, but you can see all the word Pilatus, Pontius Pilate. Below that you cannot see prefect very well, but you can see Judea. So let's take another view of it here. Top line you see Tiberius, then you see part of Pontius, and you see all of Pilatus. And you see all of Judea. And here is a clearer view. Here is a reconstruction of those words. Caesar Tiberius, Pontius Pilate, and he is the prefect of Judea. So this is extra-biblical evidence of his reality. Pontius Pilate was not a fictitious character. He built some kind of a memorial to Caesar Tiberius. When that memorial was torn down, those stones were used in secondary building. Those stones were found, and you can see them today when you go to Israel. And you will go to Israel, right?
Right.
Of course, right. Okay. And so that picture is at the top of your article there on page 9. All righty. Well, let's take our break, and we'll pick it up on page 10. So go ahead and take your break. All righty, we're underway again. Now we're picking it up on section 233, lesson 14, page 10 at the top of the page. Okay, section 233 is the first Roman trial, the first Roman phase before Pilate. Section 233 is at the bottom of page 231 in your harmony. And we'll be looking at we'll start in the Luke account, which is the center right column, Luke chapter 23, verse 1. Then the whole body of them arose and brought him before Pilate. So this is the first trial before Pilate. We'll see that it takes place in the Praetorium, which is probably the Antonia Fortress. Now, here we are on the Western Hill, modern Mount Zion today, Western Hill. And Yeshua is probably taken down those first century stairs into the Tyropian Valley, and then up the Tyropian Valley, which is along the west side of the temple area, and over to the Tower of Antonio. That's probably where the Praetorium was located. Western corner of the Temple Mount. Here is how it looks today, again down from the Western Hill, north in the Tyropian Valley along the side of the temple platform that's there today. And then there's an Arab school right there. That building is an Arab school, sits on the foundations of the Antonio Fortress. And here is a drawing of possible way the Antonio Fortress looked. There it is in the northwestern corner, butted right up against the Temple Mount. Here is the model of first century Jerusalem in the Israel Museum. And there's the Fortress of Antonio there, the Romans garrison troops there. It was the home of a bunch of Roman soldiers. And here we're in the Temple courtyard, looking to the north at the Fortress of Antonio. And from another view, we're now on the Western Hill looking across the Tyropian Valley. Now, look down in the right-hand corner. There's a possible route for Jesus to be taken through the twisting alleyways and narrow streets of the old city. Then under Robinson's Arch and along the Tyropian Valley, past the Western Wall as we know it today, and there over to the Antonio Fortress. So that's a possible route Yeshua could have been taken. Again, here, looking at the bottom right corner, I've got Yeshua being taken along the Tyropian Valley, behind that building, and to the stairs going up into the Fortress of Antonio. The Temple Mount, of course, is on the right there. Now, we can take that same journey ourselves through the graphics of the Globe Bible. There's Robinson's Arch, and you can walk on these stones today when you go to Israel. Those of you who have gone to Israel with me, we've walked on these stones. All right? We're going under the arch along the... this would be the commercial area with the little shops on the right and left. And then we're starting to climb the hill up the Tyropian Valley, and off in the distance you can see the Fortress of Antonio as we trudge along, gaining altitude, and now we're before it. And again today, there it is, the school, the Arab school, sitting on the foundations of that fortress. So if you don't know where the Antonio Fortress is by now, you never will know it, because I've just bombarded you with enough pictures, right? All right, that is probably the Praetorium, yes. No, those steps that I showed you are outside on the western hill. There are steps inside the temple area coming down to the temple area from the Praetorium. That's where he preached. Steps going up into that fortress. But I didn't focus on any of those. Okay. All righty. Now Pilate was born in Spain, and he served as a procurator from 26 to 36 A.D. So this event happens in the middle of his term as governor. Pilate was not a nice man. He was very famous for his cruelty. And you can read all about him in that article I've given you. So now it's the wee hours of the morning, and Pilate is dressed and ready to conduct a trial. And again, remember, the reason for that is earlier that night, Judas went before Pilate, and he presented the official charge by which a Roman cohort could be released. And since Pilate had earlier released the Roman cohort to Judas, Judas should have been here for the trial. Pilate is ready. Jesus the accused is here, but Judas the accuser is not. He should have stepped forward at this point in time, but he's not there to do it. So let's look at the John account. John 18:28, underneath the heading Passover Offering, verse 28. They led Yeshua, therefore, from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter in the praetorium in order that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Now, verse 28 has caused untold gallons of ink to be poured out trying to explain it. So I'm going to try and explain verse 28 to you in very, very simple terms. And the problem is the term the Passover. That's the term that's caused confusion. There's confusion because the Passover supposedly was eaten the night before. What is the term the Passover referring to if it's already been eaten at the Passover banquet, the Passover Seder? Remember, the Jewish day goes from sundown to sundown, not sunup to sunup. So Thursday night of the week was the first night of Passover, and the Passover meal was eaten then. So what's going on here? Well, a little knowledge of Jewish culture solves the problem. Now, in the morning, when the day breaks, there's a special sacrifice known as the Haggigah that's offered. The Haggigah is the official festival peace offering. It's offered immediately after the regular daily morning sacrifice. And here's that little bit of information that solves the whole problem.
Is that every day?
No, this is the Passover. The Passover, the Haggigah, only during the Passover. The little bit of information that solves the problem is that the Haggigah is also known as the Passover. Okay, now there's the differences between the Pesach, also called the Passover, and the Haggigah, called the Passover. First of all, the priests eat the Haggigah offering. The family ate the Pesach. Now, the reason why they're afraid of eating this offering lies in the fact that they are facing a rabbinic ritual defilement, a tradition. According to tradition, they would be ritually defiled if they entered the home of a Gentile. And the Praetorium was the home of all these Roman soldiers. It was their billet, their barracks. And the ritual defilement would end at sundown. That's the tradition. Now, page 11, the top of the page. Now, in the situation before us, they had to eat the Haggigah the same day that it was offered. And they had to offer it and eat it in a ritually pure state. And they had to eat it before sunset. Now, if they entered the praetorium, they would suffer ritual defilement. And there would be no chance for them to be cleansed of their defilement before eating the Haggigah. They had to eat it before sundown. So this is the problem that they're looking at. So I've explained it to you in words, and I'm going to try to also explain it to you in a chart. Now, I don't want to confuse anybody, but because misunderstanding leads to so many theories about the Passover, I want you to be very clear about this. When commentators do not understand that the term the Passover is referring to the Haggigah, they start projecting all kinds of things, like Jesus didn't really eat the Passover, he ate a preliminary Passover. Or there must have been a Galilean time frame, and he ate the Passover in the Galilean time frame. Or this, or that, or the worst projection that the commentators make is that John is contradictory to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So this is an important issue. So I don't want to confuse you, but I'm going to hit it kind of hard here. So bear with me. So if I explained it to you in words, now I'm going to try to explain it to you in a chart. If this is the Chagigah, if the word Passover refers to the Chagigah, then defilement is a problem because this rabbinic traditional defilement ends at sundown and the Chagigah had to be eaten before sundown. Time frame. Number one, the trials in the morning. If they entered the praetorium, they would suffer defilement. Frowny face, right? Not good. Not good. Secondly, the Chagigah is offered in a ritually pure state. They couldn't do that. Frowny face. Not good. They had to eat the Chagigah, the Passover, on the same day. Big frowny face. They couldn't do that either. Sun sets, then the defilement ends. See their problem? That's their problem. It's the Chagigah that's being referred to here. All right. No, they didn't have a get-out-of-jail card on this one. No, they didn't. All right. Now, remember, as we go through the notes here, I'm going to repeat it. The point that confuses commentators is the fact they don't realize that the Chagigah was also called the Passover. The term Passover is applied to both Passover sacrifices. It's applied to the offering by the family on the 14th of Nisan. The family offering is called the Passover. In addition, the title is applied to the offering made by the priests on the 15th of Nisan. The Chagigah, because it is the official Passover festival peace offering, is also called the Passover. Now, if this were a reference to the family's Passover, there would be no problem with defilement. Why? Because the family Passover is eaten after sundown. Now, this incident occurs early in the morning. Had this been the family Passover, they could have entered the praetorium, they could have suffered defilement, but they would have been cleansed of their defilement at sundown, and they could eat the Passover Seder. They could go to the Passover Seder. All right. Now, let's go through it in chart form again. Now, both of these charts are on page 12. So we're... The Pesach. The family Passover sacrifice is known as the Pesach. P-E... S-A-C-H would be fine. P-E-S-A-C-H. Pesach. This is the Chagigah that we're referring to. Okay, now, if this was the Pesach, there'd be no problem. Here we go. If this is a reference to the Pesach, then defilement is not a problem because this rabbinic traditional defilement ends at sundown. Here's what would have happened. Trials in the morning. They could have entered the praetorium. They could have suffered defilement. You know, frowny face, but no problem. In the afternoon, the Pesach, their Pesach, could have been offered by a designated member of the group. They didn't have to offer it themselves. They could get somebody else to offer it, just like Peter and John. Remember, they offered it for the disciples, for the apostles. All right? At sunset, defilement ends. Smiley face, right? And they eat the Pesach. Big smiley face. All right? You see the issue? So we're talking here about the Chagigah. Now, that one little bit of information solves all the problems. The Book of John and the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, are not contradictory. Not in the slightest. Jesus did eat a normal Passover meal, just like Matthew, Mark, and John tell us. And John is not contradictory because he's not referring to the Pesach. He's referring to the Chagigah. Does that make sense?
Why don't commentators know that
they're Jewish? Well, they know it, but they don't understand the Jewish traditions and, traditions that were centering around the Chagigah and the Pesach. Commentators are not familiar with the Jewish perspective on things. Okay? And having the Jewish perspective solves a lot of problems. Okay, so remember, if you didn't get anything, if this was confusing to you and I've kind of burned your brain, just remember, the reason I've gone through this is to show you, to prove to you, that the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, and the Book of John are not contradictory in the slightest. That's the big problem we want to avoid. Because that's when the unleavened bread is eaten, the Pesach.
Isn't that the Sabbath?
Yeah.
15, a new song?
Right.
How does that fit into
That's the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread.
And so that hasn't happened yet. And you're saying that happened.
This is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread right now. Yeah, it is not the Sabbath.
It's not the Sabbath that you're not supposed to work on.
Right. Right, but this is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's begun, okay? Because it began when the sun set and the Passover Seder was eaten. That's during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, okay? I have a chart. Not to worry. I have a chart coming up in a few pages that will go through this, okay? So again, the bottom line, you now know that the Gospels and the Book of John are totally accurate and totally consistent, okay? So let all that stuff perk in your mind, okay? And if somebody asks you, brings the issue up to you, just give them my email address, and I'll burn their brain, okay? All right, but really, really, it's very, very simple. The solution is very, very simple. All righty. Page 13. You are very patient with me. Thank you all. I see steam coming out of a few heads, but... All right, page 13. The trial begins. The trial begins. John 18, 29. We're on page 232, left-hand column, top of the page there, top of the column. John 18, 29. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" All right, remember... According to Roman law, the proceedings have to begin with a specific charge voiced by the prosecuting witness. "Judas, step forward now with your accusation." He's not there. Judas is dead. Verse 30. They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." They have no accuser. They have no witness. So the attempt to force Pilate to pass sentence apart from a witness or an accusation. Pilate knows his Roman law. Pilate is not intimidated by this. Chapter 18, first part of verse 31. Pilate therefore said to him, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." All right? He knows the Roman procedure. He was not going to proceed against Roman law. No accusation, no condemnation, no sentencing. "Get out of here. I don't want to hear this thing." The Jewish leaders respond. Second part of verse 32 and verse 31 into verse 32. The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death, that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying what kind of death he was about to die." Basically, they answer him, "We have tried him according to our law, and we want to execute him." That's basically their response. Now, I pointed this out to you earlier, that the Talmud tells us exactly at what point the Roman government took away from the Sanhedrin the power of capital punishment. They dated it 40 years before the destruction of the temple. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD, minus 40. It's the year 30 AD, the very year of this trial. And at the bottom of your page, you have the Talmudic insights from Encyclopedia Judaica on the article Capital Punishment. "The right of imposing capital punishment having been taken away from the Sanhedrin by the Romans 40 years before the destruction of the temple." Sanhedrin 41a, Jerusalem Talmud, Sanhedrin 118. Here is Sanhedrin 41a. "It has been taught, 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin were exiled from the Hall of Hewn Stones. They did not try capital charges." Remember that? A lesson or two back, we went through where the Hall of Hewn Stones probably was. "Capital charges could be tried only in the chief seat of the Sanhedrin, the Hall of Hewn Stones." And they were exiled from that location. And then the Jerusalem Talmud. "It was taught 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the right to judge capital cases was withdrawn." So according to John 18:32, This is in the providence of God, the way God made sure that Jesus dies in the manner he said he would die, the manner it was predicted he would die, by crucifixion. If the Sanhedrin had retained in their power the death penalty, they would not have crucified anyone. Crucifixion was not a Jewish mode of execution. If the Sanhedrin had the power to execute, they would have stoned Jesus to death. And if Jesus had been stoned to death, there would be no atonement, because that would have violated the manner in which Jesus said he would die, and it would have violated prophecy. For example, Psalm 22:16, this would have been violated. Messiah is speaking. For dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers have encompassed me, they pierced my hands and feet. He had to be pierced, you guys. Zechariah 12:10, God is speaking. I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so they will look on me whom they have pierced. How do you pierce God? How do you pierce God? That's the question that needs to be asked. Well, when God becomes incarnate as a man, you can. And they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son. And they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. And then Isaiah 53:5, he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening of our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we were healed. All of this has to be fulfilled. It would not have been fulfilled if Jesus had been stoned. Yes?
Is it a fair statement to make that the prophets at the time of the writing of these wouldn't have had any idea what piercing was, or would they have known?
They probably didn't know. They longed to look into some of these things. I think in the book of Hebrews it says the angels longed to look into them, that prophets longed to understand all this. It's very possible they didn't understand all that they were prophesying. Yeah. Yeah, very true. Because crucifixion was not a Jewish execution mode in David's day or in Isaiah's day. 1,000 years before, 700 years before. Who heard of it? Who knows? Okay? I need to go on, you guys, okay? I'm running short on time here, so ask me after the class, okay? This also would have been this is also a fulfillment of Genesis 49:10. Genesis 49:10 tells us, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and that's a rabbinic term for Messiah, and to him will be the obedience of the peoples. So the scepter, the ruling authority, has now departed from Judah. The Romans restrict capital punishment. They allow capital punishment only by themselves. And Shiloh has come. The Messiah has come. So the priests are stymied by all of this, and finally they come up with an accusation in the Luke account. Luke chapter 23, verse 2. So we're now in the center right column. Verse 2 is floating there in the center right column. And they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Messiah, a king. Exactly, exactly. So you're excused. So the accusation is finally voiced, sedition, insurrection against Rome. Pilate has to take this seriously. Okay? So in view of the accusation that Pilate has to take seriously, Pilate now calls for a private conference between Jesus and himself. And so I've done a little illustration. I found a little illustration of that. Just picture this in your mind. Yeshua, bound as a prisoner, now standing before the Roman governor and being questioned. So now we're at private conference. Let's see, we're on page 14. Bottom of the page, the private conference, verse 33. John 18:33. Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" So from Pilate's viewpoint, he wants to know, are you a competitor to Caesar? And Jesus responds in verse 34. Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" So basically he wants to know the basis for the question. Is it from the viewpoint of a Roman, a political basis, or is it from the viewpoint of a Jew, a religious basis? Now remember, you guys, Jesus is not ignorant here. He has read people's minds for 3.5 years. He isn't ignorant of what's going on in Pilate's mind. What he's doing here is what he's doing to everyone else. He's ministering to Pilate. He's asking him in order to get into a conversation with him so he can present him with the truth and bring Pilate to salvation, to get Pilate to exercise faith, just like he's done with everybody else. Okay? He loved Pilate too. He loved Pilate too. So Pilate responds. Let's see how the conversation goes. Verse 15, top of page 15 now. Verse 35. Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you up to me. What have you done?" So his reaction is basically, "I'm not Jewish. I could care less about your crazy little religion. I'm interested in the political realm." Verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." So Yeshua's answer explains the nature of the mystery form of the kingdom. It's the mystery form of the kingdom he's speaking of here. So he's answering from a political perspective. He's saying, "I am not a competitor to Caesar." That's his point. Now, just a little theological aside here. There are those in the church who are called amillennialists. Now, amillennialists don't believe in a literal kingdom on earth. And they like to use this verse to teach against a literal kingdom. But Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world." What they ignore is John chapter 17, where Jesus uses the same expression of the disciples. To say something is not of this world is not to say that it is not in the world. Now this comes out in John 17, verse 16, when Jesus says of the disciples, they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. They were very much in the world and would be for many more years, but they are not of the world. John 17:16 means that they are not of the world's nature. The kingdom of the Messiah will be in the world, but it's not going to be of the world in its nature. And that's because the Messiahship of Jesus has been rejected, and so the physical messianic kingdom will not be set up. In its place, we have the mystery form of the kingdom. Remember the mystery form of the kingdom. The king is absent, but he's ruling in the hearts of his followers through the indwelling Holy Spirit. So this kingdom is not of this world. You know, physical kingdoms rule by imposing law or force upon others. Yeshua's kingdom rules from inside the person, not from outside the person. Okay, see the difference? It's a world of difference. All right, verses 37 and 38. Page 233, verse 37. Pilate therefore said to him, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him." Well, Pilate asks, "Are you a king in any sense of the term?" And Jesus says, "Yes, I'm king of the truth." And cynically, sarcastically, Pilate replies, what is truth? He's a hardened man. He's hardened to the truth because this is the issue. This is where Yeshua wanted the conversation to go, to the truth. Are you looking for the truth, Pilate? And that's the issue every single one of us in this room, every single one of us in the world faces. What is the truth? Is Jesus the truth? If people are searching for the truth, God will show it to them and they'll come to salvation. So you see, he's brought Pilate right to the apex of his life. That's why he wanted to enter into this conversation with him. And Pilate is so hardened that he doesn't care one whit about the truth anymore in his life. And the irony is the fact that he looked the truth right in the eye. He was face to face with the truth, and he didn't recognize him and didn't want him. No, he's just following through on. He will in a little bit, but right now he's just following Roman procedure. So what is the result of this conference? The first declaration of innocence. Top of page 16. Top of page 16. The first declaration of innocence. Also, Luke 23 verse 4. Just move over one column to the left. And Pilate said to the chief priests and the multitudes, I find no guilt in this man. This is no competitor to Caesar. This is no threat to Rome. Or he is no threat to Rome. Move over to the Mark account, verse 3. And the chief priests began to accuse him harshly. And so the priests respond with accusation after accusation. And Yeshua's response is silence. The Matthew account. All the way to the left now, verse 12. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he made no answer. Okay, now Pilate asks for a response. In the Mark account, verses 4 and 5, Mark 15, move back to the center left column. And Pilate was questioning him again, saying, do you make no answer? See how many charges they bring against you? But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. So there's still no answer. There's no need for an answer. He's been declared innocent. He should be immediately released. There's no need for further comment. But Pilate breaks Roman law here. Here's his first deviation from Roman law. He doesn't set him free. So amid these accusations, someone finally mentioned that Jesus originates in Galilee, the Luke account, chapter 23, verse 5. That's the center right column, page 234. And they kept on insisting. He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. Aha! Now Pilate has an excuse. He has an opportunity to get off the hook and to get away from these accusations that are being flung in his way. Why? Because in the city is Herod Antipas. Herod is in the city for Passover. Now Galilee is not under the jurisdiction of Pontius Pilate. It is under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. So Pilate sends Yeshua to Herod for a trial. And we'll pick that up next week. We'll use page 17. Our application chart is our review. And we'll pick it up next week with the application chart on page 17. Now let me close in prayer, and I'll let you guys go. Father, again, I am just amazed by all that Yeshua went through and his calm dignity as he stood before this Roman governor and tried to bring him to faith as well. He reached out to him, trying to get him to acknowledge the truth. And yet Pilate was so hardened, he rejected it all. Lord, help us as we go out into a world that is more and more rejecting of the truth, that we would be willing to minister to people who are hardened and cynical, and believe the truth is relative now. You know, there is no such thing as truth if you believe it's relative. It's all just an opinion. But it's your opinion that counts. Your opinion is the truth. And so, Lord, help us to stand for the truth and to present the truth, because we know the truth will set people free. It'll set them free from their sin. It'll set them free from their resentments and their angers. So, Lord, help us to imitate Yeshua and always bring people to that position. And, Lord, encourage us by helping us to see them come to faith, to come to the truth, and kneel at the foot of the cross and accept Yeshua, receive Him as their Savior. May we do this, Lord, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And I ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, you guys, we'll see you next week.